From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. On Saturday, a gunman entered the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh during services. He screamed anti-Semitic slurs before opening fire on worshipers and killing 11 people. It was one of the deadliest attacks on Jewish people in U.S. history. The hate-inspired massacre sent shudders through congregations and all people across the country. We invited folks from Savannah and Macon's Jewish communities to talk about how they are dealing with the attack. Rabbi Robert Haas is from the congregation Mikveh Israel in Savannah. And Rabbi Robert, welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
And Adam Solander, he's executive director of the Savannah Jewish Federation. Adam, thank you for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Also with us from Macon, Rabbi Larry Schlesinger. He's Rabbi Emeritus of Temple Beth Israel there in Macon. Rabbi Larry, welcome.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Well, it is just such deeply, deeply disturbing news. Rabbi Robert, what does it look like to support members of your congregation, Mikveh Israel, in the past few days?
Well, I think we're all in a sense of shock right now. Again, living in America, you think, you know, we live in a safe country, but we also understand there are people out there who will do these things. So right now we're just mourning together, and then I think the discussions about how to ensure the safety of our congregants will ensue in the coming days. We have a big event tonight where we're going to have a vigil to bring everybody together. So I think it's a little bit of shock. It's a comforting time, and also to look forward to make sure we don't have this happen in our area.
How about you, Rabbi Larry, there in Macon? How are you reaching out?
Well, the Jewish community is really a family wherever we are. So, you know, we're taking this as a personal family loss. So we've got a memorial service scheduled in Macon Friday evening during the Sabbath evening service. And people are grieving. People are mourning, and it's not just from the Jewish community alone.
Right. Rabbi Robert, we know the Shalom Yal Jewish Food Festival was just held on Sunday there in Savannah. This is normally a time for the community to come together, celebrate over food and music. You chose not to cancel after the violence at the Tree of Life in Pittsburgh. So tell us, what was the mood there on Sunday?
Well, it was an incredible day for all of us. The weather was beautiful, as always. The food was amazing. But really, the community came out to show their dedication. We have a lot of people come anyway, but people from all walks of life, different houses of worship, asked their congregants to come to support us. We certainly thought about canceling it, but we realized that we can't let these things stop us from being ourselves and doing what's right and what's helpful for the community. And the food festival has been around for 30 years. It's been one of the ways we, you know, give back to the community. And it really was wonderful to see. I cannot tell you how many people came up to me and said, we're here to support you. Civic leaders, religious leaders. We had the bishop, the mayor. We had people from almost every congregation seemingly in the community, not just the Jewish, of course, but everybody came out. And it was really quite cathartic.
Adam, Savannah has one of the oldest Jewish communities in the United States. So what's been the significance of an event like this and others for folks deeply rooted in the community there?
Well, I think that people continue on. I mean, our history is an amazing pier that we build upon. And you know, having that together, having people who have relationships that have been around for 275 years, you really see the benefit of that. And truly, it was such a multifaceted group of people who were out on Sunday. And when you count them in the many thousands, you understand what a community really is.
Yeah, like the community in Pittsburgh, Squirrel Hill, a very old, had been there for a long time, and one of very few Jewish communities and neighborhoods that stayed intact inside of there in Pittsburgh. What is the significance of that as you look across other cities in the United States that have those kind of communities?
Well, in some ways, it seems like those are the communities that might be most vulnerable. But we know that people who have hate in their heart are going to find find you wherever you are. So it's not a situation of having these small enclaves or even large enclaves, because hate has no borders. So I think that we have to stand tall all the time and be aware and be looking out for ourselves and for others around us.
Well, you've all spoken about service to others and also unity. And for a lot of people in Georgia, terrorism against a synagogue brings to mind the bombing of the temple in Atlanta. That was 60 years ago now, 1958. At that time, white supremacists bombed the synagogue because its members supported Martin Luther King Jr. and the civil rights movement. And we now know that the gunman posted threats. He railed online against those who welcome refugees. This is central to the Jewish faith. Would you like to, Rabbi Robert, maybe illuminate that concept of helping strangers, as it said, and uniting with other groups?
Well, I think that's one of the very core beliefs in our religion. And it really speaks a lot. For instance, we live in Savannah, where everyone here is so welcoming and so supportive of each other and has been for 285 plus years. So we understand what it's like to be the other, the outsider. For generations, we were the outsider. And now that we live in this wonderful country, which is built upon so many different cultures, it's this, you know, the impetus upon us is to bring each other together, to work together, to build a great community like we have in Savannah. And I can tell you, anytime something terrible happens to a minority in our community, you're going to find every other group coming to support them. That's just what we've built here, and it's really remarkable.
How about you, Rabbi Larry, from Macon? They're a not quite as old a community, but still one bound together. This concept of remember the stranger, for we were once strangers in Egypt. I think I have the saying right.
Macon, the Jewish community, you know, came shortly after the city was founded in 1823. So its roots are deep, not as deep as Savannah's. But I think there was a difference between the bombing of the temple, which was over the civil rights issue of the time, and the shooting in the synagogue in Pittsburgh, because this was out-and-out hatred of Jews themselves. And I think we just have to, you know, really make that clear distinction. This is anti-Semitism at its most virulent form.
Among those killed, a 97-year-old woman, two men in their 80s, people who were alive during the Holocaust. So you can see that arc in their own lifetime. But to us, taught about the Holocaust, anti-Semitic history seems so long ago and belongs in another place. Now FBI data shows that Jewish people make up about half of Americans targeted by hate crimes due to religious bias. Even though they make up a small percentage of the U.S. population, Anti-Defamation League reporting an increase in anti-Semitic incidents since 2016. Have we been lulled into underestimating this problem? Do you think, I'll ask you, Larry, do we understand the events of violence in our current history and in this context?
Well, I think the Jewish community is always aware that anti-Semitic feelings lurk just beneath the surface of the communities in which we live. And we're just seeing it being expressed more and more in, you know, recent months and years. And, you know, it's very worrisome. And, you know, we should not fool ourselves that it's something that was and is not still, in effect in certain people's minds today.
Rabbi Robert, have you at the Tree of Life thought about differently about safety and security? Do you do drills, active shooter drills there?
Well, we've always taken that to heart. We've never had an incident, thank God, in Savannah, but we have guards at all our events, police cars, and we'll probably entertain thinking of doing some other things. But again, we're going to be as safe as we possibly can, but we also have to understand that hate is a part of our world, and we have to band together as a community to support each other and not allow these things to keep us from doing what we usually do. And we're a minority in this country. There's lots of minorities. There's always people looking to do something to the other, to the minority. And the best, strongest we can ever be is to band together. So we work in connection with the police. Yesterday at the food festival, we already had, 2 days ago, we already had a lot of security. We worked with the police to make sure we had a lot more. And we're going to do everything we can to ensure our safety of our congregants.
I'm curious how you talk with congregants about responding to hatred, allowing that space for anger, but of course the teaching of forgiveness. How do they coexist in the same place?
Well, that's the big question. I think there's always a little bit of everything going on. You know, hate is always there. Sometimes it's a little bit deeper. Sometimes it rises to the surface. But the best way to combat it is with respect, you know, to teach others to respect each other through education, through working with other groups. When incidents like this happen, you know, to make sure that it's not just the Jewish community supporting itself, but having everybody else come out to show that the vast majority of this wonderful country don't feel this way.
How about you, Rabbi Larry? You're now Rabbi Emeritus at Temple Beth Israel, but you spent a good amount of time being plugged into one place and one community. How have you seen this community show up for each other in difficult moments in Macon?
Well, being a small Jewish community, it's really very much family here. So, you know, whether it's a birth or a bar mitzvah, marriage, or a death, the Jewish community is there for each other because of that family spirit. And in a situation like this, you know, we all come together in grief, in mourning. I mean, that's just what Jewish community is all about. It's about togetherness.
Right now, what is giving you hope?
Well, it's really the human being itself. I mean, we human beings are really capable of, love or hate. And what I've seen is just a tremendous outpouring from the non-Jewish community, and particularly in my situation, from the African-American community. I guess Charleston is still very much in the forefront of their minds. The same thing happened there that happened in Pittsburgh, and people just are grieving, everywhere, I would say.
Well, that is a sort of, I don't know, macabre connection between the two. But these houses of worship are meant to be safe places. Rabbi Robert, how are you going to make your congregation feel safe?
Well, that's a really important question. Now, of course, there's the physical safety. We work with police. We're also a museum, so we have people coming through our doors all week long. So, one, we work with police. We talk to the congregation to make sure we're doing everything we can. But it's also about an emotional safety. And, you know, it's about teaching everyone that when something like this happens, the house of worship is there to help support the community. It's kind of like a little bit what happens sometimes in Israel. When something happens, they don't, back down. They go out and show overt support, and they really come out and say, listen, this is our community. We're here to stay. We've been here a long time. We're here to support each other emotionally. And so we will talk with people, we'll bring people together, and we'll figure out the best way to create emotional stability and also safety.
Rabbi Robert Haas from the Congregation Mikveh Israel in Savannah, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Adam Solander, he's Executive Director of the Savannah Jewish Federation. Thank you.
You're very welcome.
And Rabbi Larry Schlesinger, he's now Rabbi Emeritus of Temple Beth Israel in Macon. Thank you so much.
I thank you as well.
Now, for more information about the interfaith vigils taking place over the next week, they're at our website, gppnews.org. Just ahead, hear how women getting fired up has changed the U.S. This is On Second Thought. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. In June of 2017, Rebecca Traister traveled to Georgia to cover John Ossoff's race to beat Karen Handel in a runoff election. Landing among the newly activated women campaigning for Ossoff, she writes, was like walking onto the set of Thelma and Louise. Like the awakened heroines of the film, they had crossed over.
I can't go back. I mean, I just couldn't live.
I know what you mean.
What they meant was getting in touch with their rage. In her new book, Good and Mad, Traister follows the historic shakeups and social movements from abolition to Me Too to the historic number of women now running for local and national office, sparked when women's fury turns into action. Rebecca Traister will be reading at the Decatur Library tonight and joins us now with more on her book, Good and Mad. Rebecca, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Virginia. God, that clip. I haven't heard it in a while. Really does. That movie is, you know, the music and the voices, it's very evocative.
Yeah, and very, very seemingly revolutionary at the time, even though it was many years after the quote-unquote women's movement.
It's so interesting. You know, I was in high school when that movie came out, and I really responded to it viscerally. And my feelings about it, I've watched it several times in the years since. And, you know, there was a moment where I watched it and I was like, well, this is not very good. And then I watched it again a few years ago and I was like, oh, it's incredibly powerful. But at the time, and I actually talked to somebody about this in this book, I write about how a woman who's slightly older than I am, Laura Miller, a book critic at Slate, told me about how uncomfortable that movie made men in ways that I think are very related to the way that a contemporary politicization is making some men uncomfortable at this point. You know, women's lives being changed as they become civically engaged and participants in a protest and electoral life that perhaps some of them hadn't been before. My former colleague Laura Miller said to me, remembering the Thelma and Louise release, when she was, as a few years older than me, you know, a young woman, she said the men around her hated it. They were so scared of it. They hated that movie. It made them feel so threatened and so uncomfortable, you know, and she was talking about a specific scene. But, you know, that's something that I write about a little bit in the book, that when women are awakened to anger and begin expressing it and listening to anger from the women around them and working with the women around them, it can be so discomforting for the men.
Well, that's the thing. In Roswell and Cobb counties, these are traditionally Republican suburban districts, you write about women's anger becoming audible to each other. People weren't necessarily accustomed to political activism and even said, I don't know how to protest. Here's one of them, Jen Cox.
I was afraid that it would affect even perhaps my kids' relationships with their friends. We were all making a lot of assumptions that terrible things would happen if we came out as liberals.
Came out as liberals, mm-hmm. out of the closet. Now, this is a realm, as you point out many times in the book, is something that many women of color grew up with or are used to.
Well, it's so complicated and the roots are very deep. One of the things that we have to reckon with and that I'm trying to reckon with myself and ask readers to reckon with via this book are the ways in which white patriarchy has worked throughout this country's history. And one of the ways that it works is that, you know, you have a white patriarchy, which is fundamentally a kind of minority rule, right, in which white men are offered all kinds of power, political power, economic power, social and sexual power. And they're a minority part of the population, and yet they have a tighter grip on that power than the majority has. And how in a democracy does a minority power hold on when theoretically the members of that majority could join together and vote it out, you know, or overthrow it or alter the power structure? Well, in part, the way you do that is by offering incentives to members of that subjugated or underrepresented majority. There are a lot of incentives to not be the troublemaker, right? And that's what a lot of white women who have been Democrats for a long time, and it was in Roswell and Cobb counties in Georgia's 6th that I first really began to hear this story. And it was very moving to me. White suburban women who had long had progressive or democratic ideas, but hadn't, what Jen Cox was just describing, hadn't wanted to rock the boat. They hadn't wanted to be those discomforting forces, right? They hadn't wanted to make their communities feel like they were troublemakers or challengers or unpleasant. They didn't want to even put out a yard sign. And that's one of the things that happens within white patriarchy, where there's a reward kind of offered to white women who don't rock the boat, which is you'll be accepted in our community, in our society, society. We won't label you a troublemaker. Now, those rewards have never been offered to women of color, right? They get neither the rewards or the power offered by white supremacy, nor the rewards or power offered by patriarchy. And Brittany Cooper, who's really, she's a scholar and the author of another book about women's anger, Eloquent Rage, that is just so incandescently good. She has taught me about how the fact that women of color and black women have never been offered any kind of incentive to support white patriarchy has, in fact, permitted them to be the thought leaders, the intellectual and organizing groundbreakers of so many progressive movements that have wound up transforming this nation. But for white women, who there are so many incentives offered to not be disruptive, the moment at which the anger becomes so intense that it bubbles over, which is, of course, what happened for a lot of women in Georgia 6th and all over the country in the wake of the 2016 election, this is a new entrance into a progressive political coalition. And as Jen Cox and many others have said, it is a kind of language of personal transformation, of coming out, of revealing one's true self. And when you reveal that self, which is in part angry at inequality, at unfairness, at injustice, you're finding people who may have been living on your block this whole time also trying not to be the disruptive forces in the community. But it turns out that you were frustrated about the same things for a long time. But now that you can hear each other and see each other and begin to work together, what you can do is organize.
One of the things that you introduced was the idea that there's a concerted attempt to really shut women's anger down because it is considered disruptive to the social order, because it is corrosive. And looking at some of the words that are used to describe women's anger in the book, of course, there's Hillary Clinton's cackle. She's told to smile more. Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, she's described it barking at another senator, Maxine Waters, of having a meltdown. Is this run-of-the-mill sexist language or part of what that argument is in your book, a concerted attempt to shut women's anger down?
Well, I think very often that run-of-the-mill sexism happens at the very same time or is part of efforts to shut down women's power and to rob them of their power, right? Those things, what we tend to throw away is like, oh, that's just everyday misogyny. Well, everyday misogyny has a tactical, strategic use for people who want to continue to subjugate and oppress women. And so, yes, I think it's both things. The characterizations of women who are angry in this culture sort of run the gamut. And again, they depend on the power of those women, the race of those women, the economic position of those women. But we are familiar. We know in our bones as women how our anger will be used to undermine us, right? If we express it, that it'll make us sound unreliable, over-emotional, hysterical, or, and this is especially true for women of color, threatening, scary. We know that when women raise their voices and object to the confirmation of Brett Kavanaugh, despite there being credible testimony that he committed a violent assault in his youth, despite there being ample evidence of his perjury, when women raise their voices peacefully but just yell through his confirmation vote, they'll be characterized as a mob. That if women simply tell the stories of having been harassed or assaulted by powerful people in their workplaces, they will be characterized as participating in a witch hunt. We know that the very act of expressing anger or loud dissent will get us characterized as disruptive aggressors. And that is sexism, and it is also part of a strategy to keep us from voicing that dissent, because in voicing it, that anger connects us to other women who share our anger and leads us to the possibility of organizing to change the things that we're angry about.
Well, let's get an example of that. Your book did come out before the Senate voted to confirm Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court. But the morning after the testimony of both Christine Blasey Ford and Brett Kavanaugh, which I really want to get to with you because I'm sure you have an interesting perspective, but to get to that mob idea, there was this display of female rage when two women confronted Senator Jeff Flake in an elevator after he announced he'd support Brett Kavanaugh's nomination.
You're telling all women that they don't matter, that they should just stay quiet because if they tell you what happened to them, you're going to ignore them. That's what happened to me, and that's what you're telling all women in America, that they don't matter. They should just keep it to themselves, because if they have told the truth, you're just going to help that man to power anyway. That's what you're telling all of these women. That's what you're telling me right now. Look at me when I'm talking to you. You're telling me that my assault doesn't matter. That what happened to me doesn't matter.
No, we can't say what effect that unrestrained emotion, rage, really had on it. But how would you write about those events in a future edition, for example, of Good and Mad?
Oh, well, for one thing, I can say that listening to that clip, which over the course of these weeks that I've been out on book tour, I've probably heard a dozen times, it was still, I mean, it makes me cry.
Yeah.
I mean, listening to that just now, and this honestly must be the 40th time that I've heard that audio, I will still get choked up listening to it because the expression of that rage, and in fact, the way that part of what she's saying is, this is a message you're telling us about our efforts to tell the stories of our lives. In fact, you know, I just used that example without even particularly thinking of Ana Maria Archila and Maria Gallagher, those two women in the elevator, of saying that one of the forms of angry dissent is simply telling the stories of assault or abuse. That, of course, was part of what comprised the hashtag MeToo movement in 2017. And what she's saying is, look at how you're discouraging us, women, from telling the stories of our lives and the ways in which we've been aggressed upon, or assaulted or harassed. And she's sort of acknowledging there's a strategy there. You're telling us that even if we speak up, it's not going to matter. You're going to pretend we're invisible. You know, she's giving voice to the way this process works. And her voice is shaking, and she's demanding that he look at her and that he acknowledge her humanity. And that, I can tell you right now, that is so powerful to so many millions of people who were feeling that level of rage and frustration but weren't in the elevator in Washington, were sitting in their homes or in their offices or their cubicles or in their cars or listening somewhere, and finding that these women gave voice to their fury. And that is a powerful, connective, and I believe catalytic moment. And, you know, you mentioned the testimony of Christine Blasey Ford, and she was trying to make a point to the most powerful people in the room.
Yeah,
she was trying to make...
It strikes me at how different, you know, how restrained, how compliant. I mean, clearly,
yes,
she was so nervous. Yes.
But not only nervous, she was very trained. There's a deep structural difference in the messages that both of those kinds of speech were trying to send and to whom they were sending them.
I understand and appreciate the importance of your hearing from me directly about what happened to me and the impact that it has had on my life and on my family.
Christine Blasey Ford was addressing, in addition to the, you know, the world who was watching, she had to make her case to the most powerful people in this scenario, the people who are going to vote to confirm Brett Kavanaugh to a lifetime appointment on the Supreme Court. And she's addressing the powerful. And what did we say earlier? That when women voice their anger, it is discomforting to the people in power. We had already seen with those very Republicans on the Senate Judiciary Committee, Orrin Hatch objecting to protesters weeks before, even before that Christine Blasey Ford allegations had become public, where he said to protesters protesting health care repeal and abortion, Roe v. Wade appeal, he'd said, we got to get these loudmouths out of here. We shouldn't have to deal with this. And Ben Sasse had already characterized those protesters as hysterical. She didn't have that rhetorical option of expressing her anger. And so she fit her testimony right within this narrow range of expression that she knew she could use if she wanted her story to be heard by the powerful men in that room.
If she'd been belligerent, what would have happened?
Oh, it's unthinkable. We can't imagine a version of Christine Blasey Ford. She would have immediately been written off as hysterical, as having had an axe to grind, as having been over-emotional, her testimony unreliable because it was clearly rooted in so much anger. Anger in women, because women are presumed to start from a point of irrationality. They are presumed to start from a point of emotional response. So a show of anger, if she had voiced an aggressive challenge to that power by being belligerent, talking back to them, raising her voice, she would have been tossed out of there. It would have been written off as hysteria performed, representing the angry mob of belligerent feminists, right? It would never have worked. As it was, her narrow range came as close as it was going to be possible to come, I think, in persuading people that she was telling the truth. But what she couldn't do is what Brett Kavanaugh was able to do later that afternoon. Because he could come in, and because he is a white man and a powerful white man, walks in with the presumption of rationality as our normative citizen, the powerful white man, the one who is assumed by his very presence and being to be a reasonable actor and thinker. And in his case, he is able to use his anger to amplify the point he wants to make.
I was number one in the class.
I thought only the Senate.
You got this up. I'm gonna talk about my high school.
Let him answer.
Not only is she not allowed to use it, and he is allowed, he can use it to his benefit, whereas for her, it would have been to her detriment. Because we have always revered the rage of white men. This is our national lullaby. It is our founding. It is the founders dumping tea into Boston Harbor. It is give me liberty or give me death, live free or die. So he could use it to his benefit. The difference with those two women the next day in the elevator. Now, they are addressing a powerful man in the context of the elevator. But the real power of that anger was to the masses, to the people who didn't have power, who didn't have a voice, who weren't able to vote to confirm or deny confirmation to this guy. And that's how that anger worked communicatively, because while it was addressed to one powerful man, its real power was how it went viral and was heard by the masses and channeled their sort of inexpressible rage.
Rebecca Traister, you are not in your narrow range. I'm really glad to speak with you. She is author of Good and Mad, The Revolutionary Power of Woman's Anger. We'll be back in just a moment with more. This is On Second Thought from GPB. I'm Virginia Prescott. Well, my conversation with Rebecca Traister continues. Her new book is called Good and Mad and explores what she calls the revolutionary power of women's anger. This message that, of course, anger is unattractive in women, but suppressing it, there are several spiritual traditions, you know, the Christian tradition, the Buddhist tradition. After reading the book, I went back to rewatch Hillary Clinton during the Benghazi hearings and found the headline, you know, Hillary Clinton shows yoga poise during Benghazi hearings. Is there a kind of moral superiority or tactic in suppressing anger?
Oh, yes. We're congratulated for suppressing our anger right and left, literally politically right and politically left. Barbara Lee, the remarkable congresswoman from California, tells a story in the book of how for years she was the only member of Congress to vote against the authorization for the use of military force in 2001 after September 11th. And for 16 years afterwards, she has worked to repeal that authorization for the use of military force, which permits government to go to engage military action without Congress's approval. And she's been working at it. In the summer of 2017, she actually finally passed the repeal with bipartisan support. It was like the only functional thing that happened in the government during 2017, in the federal government. And then Paul Ryan stripped the repeal from the bill that it was in for no reason.
Overnight, in the middle of the night.
And she had every reason in the world to be livid about this. And she had to appear in front of one of her colleagues to make the argument about why had this happened, this should not have happened. And she tells the story in the book really movingly about how her internal machinations to not show her anger, to not raise her voice. And she said, I knew if I showed my anger, it would undermine my point. I'd get written off as the angry black woman. They wouldn't hear what I had to say. I wouldn't be taken seriously. It would hurt me to show the anger that she had every right to feel. And so she describes that process, which will be familiar to a lot of people from a lot of angles. And then afterwards, she talks about how many of her friends, her white friends, peers, compatriots, congratulated her on holding it together and how angry that made her, because she said, you don't even know. You don't even know the work I had to do as a black woman to hold that anger in, and how unfair it is that I wasn't allowed to express the anger that I had every reason to feel.
Well, Barbara Lee's story is so instructive about how one has to perform this calculation inside of the head in order to figure out how mad can I be. But there's going to be a difference between the power bases and the needs and the concerns of those women standing shoulder to shoulder, right? How do they hear each other's anger if the issues are so different?
The issues are so vast, so diverse, and they always have been. And the challenge in front of progressive coalitions is not to paper over the differences and, in fact, the internecine angers, the anger and inequities within progressive coalitions. You know, and this is something that Audre Lorde was arguing in the early 80s in her, you know, crucial essay, The Uses of Anger, where she writes about the anger over racism between white and black feminists. And she argues that the expression of that anger and the act of listening to the anger of black women about racism within a women's movement is crucial to the forward motion of that women's movement, that anger expressed between women can be generative, can take us to the next place, and that the idea of suppressing it further, even between would-be allies, is what's damaging within the progressive coalitions as well. And so part of the challenge moving forward is to listen for the anger of those who share our frustrations, listen to their anger about lots of things, including if some of that anger is at us.
You reminded me of Audre Lorde's line, "Your silence won't protect you."
Exactly.
And you write in the book about the period in which you're writing this book, which is a really concentrated period of time in your life, as one of the healthiest because of your anger, because you are contacting that anger. What has that done for you personally?
Well, I think it's not even about contacting the anger. It's about the fact that I was in this very unusual position, which is I was writing a book about anger, which meant that I was literally being paid. It was my job every day for a period of 4 months, which is when I drafted this book, to be angry every day and to take the anger of other women seriously, to take the history of women's anger seriously, and yeah, to take my own anger seriously. And so mostly it was this like extremely privileged experience of living in like an anger biodome where nobody was telling me it was invalid, quite the contrary. No one was telling me it made me sound crazy, quite the contrary. And I was just getting to express my anger every day as if it were, you know, part of a normal range of human reaction to inequality, which I believe it is. But that's such a rare experience and one afforded by my very unusual position. And I was healthy during those 4 months. I realized at the beginning of the book, as I started to draft it, in my introduction, I'd written, of course, anger can be bad for you, because that's what I'd understood, right? We all understand. Who wants to be angry all the time? It's bad for you. At the end of those 4 months, when I went back and looked at that part of the introduction, I was like, you know what? I have never felt better than I have these 4 months. I slept really well. I wanted to exercise without being on any kind of exercise regimen. I ate better without being on any kind of dietary regimen. I had good sex. My relationships with members of my family were strong and communicative. It was a wonderful period of like, I felt like a full human. And I realized in retrospect, oh, maybe that's because I was able to express anger with the feeling that it was going to be taken seriously in the world, and being able to express it, to write it down, to have it not marginalized or laughed at or turned into something monstrous, then it's out. You've said it. Then it doesn't have to define you. I sometimes think that in swallowing our anger, we make it mean so much more to us so that it comes to define us even more, when if it could just be part of how we express ourselves every day alongside our joy and our fear and our contentment and our exhaustion, it wouldn't loom so large and, in fact, could just be one of the many human impulses and reasonable responses that guide us toward action and engagement in the world.
Rebecca Traister, encouraging a full range. She's an author of the New York Times bestseller, All the Single Ladies, and now Good and Mad, The Revolutionary Power of Women's Anger. She's going to be speaking at the Decatur Library this evening. And for more information on the book and the event, you can visit gpbnews.org. Rebecca Traister, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much, Virginia. It was great to be here.
Tomorrow on the show, ghoulish tales of zombie lore and spooky stories of meandering spirits. It's a special Halloween episode of On Second Thought. Join us for that tomorrow morning at 9. Mix jazz, soul, classical, and pop together, and what do you get? Candace Springs.
No, I don't need the real thing. Oh, your bond to the woman in me is free. No, I don't need the real thing. Don't need the real thing.
And And that's Candace Springs singing Don't Need the Real Thing from her new album, Indigo. She was signed to Blue Note Records in 2014. That's the label known for jazz greats from John Coltrane to Herbie Hancock. And she's performing in Atlanta this Saturday at City Winery and joining us from Philadelphia to talk about her new music. Welcome, Candace.
Hey, how are you doing?
Great. Great to speak with you. Who grew up around music? I guess your dad was a singer. What did he do?
He's an incredible singer. He goes by Scat Springs, and he's like my biggest inspiration. And, you know, thanks to him, I'm in this industry and learned so much about it because of him.
Well, growing up with a dad named Scat Springs, did you have any choice?
I guess not, huh?
Who did he sang himself, but he also sang, I guess, backup. Who was around that you knew through your dad?
Well, he sang back up for Aretha Franklin, Chaka Khan, to Brian McKnight, Michael McDonald, to all the country stars since we live in Nashville, like Garth Brooks, Vince Gill, Faith Hill.
Yeah, I've heard of those people.
Many more. Uh-huh, yeah. So he's gotten around, for sure.
Was singing always the goal for you?
Actually, it really wasn't. Like, first I got into playing piano, and I was like, I'll just be happy, you know, being a musician, playing. And then my dad pushed me to sing. He's like, you need to sing, Candace, because it'll open up your world even more. Because I guess he's a singer, so he'd know best, huh?
So I guess so. But do you remember that first performance, not just playing the piano, but singing?
Yeah, I do. I was about 14 when I finally got the strength to sing. I've been playing since I was 10 years old. And I play a lot of jazz. My influences are Nina Simone, Roberta Flack, Sade, Bill Evans, Luther Vandross, and many more. I love classical like Chopin and Rachmaninoff and stuff. But singing really... came along later in my early teens, I'd say, around 13, 14.
Well, it seems you caught on because we've got a song from your newest record, Indigo, reflecting a lot of influence, I'd say, jazz to R&B to classical. Here is The First Time Ever I Saw Your Face.
First time ever I saw.
Boy, that's a song made famous by Roberta Flack, sung there by my guest Candace Springs. Really strong connection, I think, to the music of the past. How do you make that new? What does that mean to you?
Man, just listening to them and taking bits and pieces of what they gave to this world, you know, and still give. I've, you know, developed my own sound over time. But, I mean... Roberta is the queen, you know?
Yeah.
So I have so much respect for what she does. I love how she makes such timeless music, and that's ultimately what I want to do.
Yeah, well, you're from Nashville, so-called Music City, cradle of America's country music. But what drew you to, you know, deep soul music like that and jazz tunes?
I guess, again, going back to my father, he's a soul singer, but he's gotten around as far as, like, different... There's a lot of music there, especially now. It's grown. Nashville's grown so much. And there's everything from R&B, soul, gospel, blues, country, Americana, everything. And you get a little of everything when you go. You can just walk down the street and almost everybody can pick up a guitar and play. Almost everybody can sit down and write a song. So it's almost inevitable.
So surrounded by music. Well, you mentioned loving Roberta Flack and Nina Simone. Nina Simone, somebody who strikes me that you could not peg into a genre.
That's right. And I really, really love that about her. She's almost like her own like hybrid, I guess you could say. And I guess my new record's sort of like that. It goes all over the place. It's from classical like she does. She's an incredible pianist. And also to bossa nova, kind of all of that, everything. So,
Well, some of the reviews say your music recalls Billie Holiday, Nina Simone, Ella Fitzgerald. Pretty high praise. But it's also... It's not technique, I don't think. I think it's feeling or experience. What do you think? What do you find in that kind of music, that tradition that you can't find elsewhere?
That's a tough question, but...
I'm not here to ask the easy questions, Candace.
Right? Oh, no, girl. Those are great questions, too. I'm not... I mean, whatever I've taken from them, I've... it's timelessness. They're there themselves. They didn't care about what anybody else thought about who they were, and they're themselves. And they sing from their soul, and you feel it. And that's what ultimately people respond to, the realness of that. And that's the stuff that stands the test of time.
Yeah. Well, the title, Indigo, where did that come from?
That came from a couple different things. One of the biggest reasons is there came a point in time, my early 20s, I wasn't sure if music was what I wanted to do. And so a friend of mine invited me to play at this club in Nashville called Indigo, Hotel Indigo. And I wasn't even supposed to play that night. And they said, come on up, Candace. So I played a song. And people were like, wow, like, are you a musician? Do you play? And they're like, you really should pursue this. So that was a turning point in my life, thanks to that hotel, Hotel Indigo.
Mm, so it's not about having deep blues?
It is a little bit too. The color is vibey. Mm. The record is vibey. And so it kind of takes you several different places.
Indigo is the name of the new album by Candace Springs. I'm speaking with her. She's going to be at the City Winery on Saturday in Atlanta. Well, among those who have been drawn to your voice, Prince, who said your voice could melt snow. You worked with him. How did that happen?
Yeah, it kind of came as a surprise. I was on my Twitter account, hanging out in New York, and my phone goes off, and I start getting these messages and stuff from him saying, who are you? He had just retweeted a video that I had just posted the day before. It's Stay With Me.
The Sam Smith song? Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. It was just a cover of me on the piano and singing, and I guess he was drawn to it, and he retweeted it on his page, and he said, this is all you need to all his fans, I guess. And on it was in 2014. And he had invited me to play at the 30th Purple Rain anniversary, like last minute that following weekend. So next thing I know, I'm on a plane going out there, and I meet him and got to collaborate with his two bands, New Power Generation Quartet and Third Eye Girl. Ugh. So, you know, it's something I'll never forget.
Many questions. What did you sing for the Paisley Park 30th anniversary of Purple Rain?
I sang First Time Ever I Saw Your Face.
Wow.
Such a powerful song. It's my favorite song on the album by far.
So what was it like meeting Prince? I'm so curious about that first encounter.
He's always like the element of surprise. It's like his thing. So I remember when we got there and we're talking to some of his staff, I guess, and then this door opens up and there he is. He's like, and I just run up. I was so excited and I gave him a hug and he was a little startled, like, oh hello. And so he said, then the first next thing he wants to do is he just wants to start rehearsing. So he was all about music. And we got straight to it and started rehearsing. After we finished our first song, he did a little, and he like collapsed on the ground. I'm not even kidding you. He literally did that. My mind was blown.
Before we go, I just want to talk quickly about another one of the songs on the album. It's called Piece of Me. Here's just a little bit of it. How much more can one heart do? Plain to see that boy, you ain't releasing me. So take another piece. I hear a little bit of Sade in that song.
Yes.
Candace, you're a super gifted singer and songwriter, but what would be something that fans would not know about you?
One of them, I'm slowly, you know, showing the other side of it. I love cars.
What?
Like, I'm a little lady gearhead. So I collect cars, tell you all about them. So my latest toy that I just bought is a 1928 tea bucket. It's got a 454 big block in it. Headers come out the sides, loud, so everybody knows I'm coming down the road.
So you drive around in that in Nashville?
Yeah, you can see it on my Instagram. I got it on there.
That's how we will know Candace Springs.
Yes, ma'am.
Well, ride on, Candace Springs. So nice to talk with you.
Thank you, guys. Peace out.
Singer and songwriter Candace Springs. Her album Indigo is in stores today, and she's performing in Atlanta at City Winery on Saturday. And that is it for our show for today. Our On Second Thought team, Elena Rivera, Leighton Rowell, LaRaven Taylor, Alex Word, although Tyler Moore is sitting in today, and Amy Kiley is our senior producer. Be sure to join us for a special Halloween episode of On Second Thoughts tomorrow, if you're not too scared. And we want to invite you to a special book club opportunity. We've got a book at the table going on with the ladies from A Seat at the Table. You can find details at our website, gppnews.org.